This is a quote. From positively impacting human health and better treating disease to enabling a better understanding of the environment and potentially creating new biological sources of energy, genomics is the field of science that has the power to transform the world around us. Those words are taken from the website of the J. Craig Venter Institute. One of the great landmarks in the history of science, and perhaps of humanity, occurred when Craig Venter and his team published the first sequence and analysis of the human genome. What made this event so remarkable was not only the accomplishment itself, but the fact that it was achieved earlier and for less money than the government-sponsored Human Genome Project. Venter is a remarkable and, I'd say, an entrepreneurial scientist. As such, he asks huge questions, takes on huge challenges, and has achieved huge successes. Weekly, those of you who listen on a regular basis know that I say that Free Forum explores the lives, the work, and the ideas of individuals that I suspect have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at new, innovative, provocative approaches to business, environment, health, science, politics, and culture, all based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. Craig Venter and his work involve an awful lot of that weekly quoted mission. In September 2007, a team led by Venter published his complete DNA sequence. That's his own complete DNA sequence in unveiling the 6 billion letter genome of a single individual for the first time. And Craig Venter has authored a new book, A Life Decoded, My Genome, My Life. Welcome, Craig.
Thank you. Nice to be with you.
Very good. I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas. And your book weaves your own biography with the stories of the scientific breakthroughs. You were an average and an indifferent student, perhaps even a bit of a troublemaker. How do you explain your transformation to an eminent scientist, and how do you link your later success with your earlier failure?
Well, it's actually it's an important question. I wasn't even an average student. I was deliberately below average, I think. I enjoyed building boats, swimming, surfing in the cold waters off of Northern California. My friends and I had one wetsuit we traded between us, but anything other than school was enjoyable. I graduated from high school barely. I got a D minus instead of an F in a government class. I knew my government instructor was a very right-wing, and this was 1964. I wrote a paper on why I thought Barry Goldwater should be president, and so he was so pleased he graduated me. So it was the ultimate irony of getting me out the door.
I was class of 65. It would have worked for me, too, I'll tell you. And then?
And then I moved to Southern California. I left home at age 17 to take up a surfing career. It didn't last long. I got drafted off my surfboard in 1965. Unbeknownst to the naive world I grew up in California, the war was expanding in Vietnam, and I was soon to become part of it. So I ended up in the Navy as a medical corpsman after treating infectious disease for a while in Balboa Hospital. I got sent to Vietnam.
And you mentioned that that experience in Vietnam was really impactful in all sorts of ways for the fact that you actually are still alive and for what you've done with your life since then.
It shows, in fact, how important the environment is and how what happens to us in life can totally change the directions. I found that knowledge was power. The more knowledge I had, the more people's lives I could save, the more I could do. But also dealing with life and death every day in the most intense fashion, including during the Tet Offensive, I began to question a life, what it was, how it existed, what it meant when it disappeared. And I felt I couldn't go back to just being a surfer, and I started my life over in a community college.
Isn't there a moment where you actually attempt suicide or the verge of attempting suicide?
Yes, it was after being there about 6 months. I was just very upset with the policies that had us there. Nobody there believed in it, and certainly as a 20-year-old dealing with large numbers of young men my own age being killed or severely maimed, it just all seemed senseless. And I decided to try and get away from it by swimming out into the sea, but a shark interrupted my train, and I quickly changed directions, and I hadn't thought about that since.
Yeah, but you say that actually it was in, and I can imagine, in the swimming back, and you say you pass the lives of the people in Vietnam and so on, and you realize that how selfish that would have been.
Yeah, in fact, on my way back from the beach of doing that, I passed all these bamboo cages that you could only squat in that were full of Viet Cong and POWs that clearly wouldn't have understand that act. They were really kept as animals in cages, and it was a combination of all these things at once that, you know, I decided to make sure I accomplished something with my life if I survived the rest of the year there.
And how did that accomplishment end up in science?
Well, I decided I was going to come back and go through 12 years of school to get back to doing what I was doing in Vietnam, practicing medicine. One of the most exciting things I did, I was a doctor for a small village, an orphanage, and it was incredibly rewarding using my knowledge to affect people's lives. My plan was to come back and practice third world medicine, but it was actually after a year and a half in a community college, transferred to UC San Diego, I was introduced to high-end science as an undergraduate, and I made an early discovery on how adrenaline worked on cells. There was no turning back. I just fell in love with science, the fact that you could use your brain to solve problems about the basic world around us, and that knowledge would affect a large number of people. I published my first scientific paper as an undergraduate, and I was hooked for life.
Let me say that in reading your book, it seems that once we get into the science part, it is as much about the politics that goes on in science as it is about the science itself. So let me read you a couple of quotes, and then I'm going to ask you to talk about that whole issue, okay? One is the thing I said in the intro, which is that one of the great landmarks in the history of science and of humanity occurred when Craig Venter published the first sequence and analysis of the human genome, that you did it earlier and for less money than the government-sponsored Human Genome Project. And my question about that is, what if anything in that is still, to some people, controversial?
Well, it's clearly controversial to the people that I beat. They will probably go to their graves not forgiving me for that. Look, it was a large, multi-billion-dollar federal program that didn't really allow room for new ingenuity. And we came along with an idea. We actually decoded the first genomes in history and then set out to apply these same new techniques using computers, high-end math, you know, small teams, and automation to do what was supposed to take tens of thousands of scientists and billions of dollars to do. And we couldn't get the funds from the government to do it. An instrument manufacturer came along and offered me $300 million to sequence the human genome. The only catch was I had to form a company with them to do it. We put a stipulation that we had to be able to publish the data in the scientific literature. They agreed to that. And we sequenced it in 9 months for $100 million instead of 15 years for $3
billion. What I'm not sure you said, or at least I didn't hear, was that you actually were within the government program.
Yes, I was at NIH for 9 years of my career, and it was actually a great period of time. The intramural program is very different than how we fund science at universities. There I was had a multi-million dollar budget and could do what I wanted to do. I just outgrew it trying to work on scaling up to do the human genome and was offered my own research institution, which I formed in 1992. And that led to the first genome in history and then to the human genome.
And the first genome was a bacteria,
It was a bacteria, Haemophilus influenzae, that causes ear infections in kids and meningitis.
Now let me read you another quote. This one is from that learned journal, the Wikipedia. But, you know, the Wikipedia is now, as I'm sure, as read, if not more, than any other pedia around. And it talks about, this is a quote from Wikipedia in the Craig Venter biography. The aim of the Celera Project, which is the company that you went to when you left the National Institute of Health, was to create a database of genomic data that users could subscribe to for a fee. This proved very unpopular in the genetics community and spurred several groups to redouble their efforts to produce the full sequence and release it as open access. The Human Genome Project, which was composed of many groups from around the world, rendered the attempt to privatize the process unfeasible. How much of that is accurate to your
Wikipedia
reading?
Doesn't always get it right. You know, it sounds like one of my competitors wrote my biography. In fact, the goal was, and what we did was made it, the sequence all publicly available. So the challenge of those who offered me the $300 million to sequence the human genome, after agreeing that I could publish it and release it, they said, okay, well, we're going to give you all this money to do it. You have to come up with a business plan that makes us look credible with this.
And let me just point out to listeners, what you're saying is since you made a condition of your moving there that you would make stuff publicly available, they're going, well, how do we tell our investors that we're going to make money?
Exactly.
Yeah.
That was precisely the discussion. And we came up with the Bloomberg model of which is not owning data, it's not owning information, it's adding value to it by creating databases and unique combinations of data that make it far easier to use that. And so our competitors knew we weren't tying up the genome. They knew we were not patenting the genome. Biologists apparently play very badly when you threaten their $3 billion budgets. And I think people said a lot of things back then that I'm sure they regret. That had nothing to do with the science. It wasn't a clean competition when they went after us for anything they could to try and discredit us. They all, by the way, have all adopted the tools that they were so trying to discredit. Every lab in the world now uses what we proposed. And that's how science moves forward. It's unfortunate. It's human nature. That's the history of scientific breakthroughs. You can't get support for them. Then a few years later, everybody says they were obvious and you didn't really do anything unique. So that's what happened here. And it was interesting because it was so public and showed that, if anything, scientists are at least as human as the rest of the population.
Yeah, let me just share with you, Craig. I actually saw in previews a play on Broadway, which, do you know what I'm talking about?
I've seen part of the script. I haven't seen the play. Yeah.
This is the Sorkin play about the Farnsworth invention, which is the invention of television. Yeah. And such a similar story there.
You find it repeated throughout human history.
Any breakthrough worth having is...
Well, they don't come easy, and I guess that it's the test of whether people believe in what they're doing. So now, because I believed it, and I'm charged with having the largest ego on the planet, so you're damned if you do and damned if you don't. But, right. You know, believing in yourself, and I had a wonderful team of scientists that I believed in totally, and they proved that they could do things beyond what even they thought they were capable of.
It faster.
One of the most exciting periods in science, actually, with what was accomplished. And I think history will eventually show that.
If you've gotten to where you can make the science part of this understandable in a brief way, in other words, what were the breakthroughs that allowed you guys to do it and to do it quicker and cheaper?
So our genome is 6 billion letters of genetic code. So the question is, how do you decode? How do you read those 6 billion letters? The best technology could read 600 to 800 letters at a time. And so the challenge is, it's like, how do you read a Sunday LA Times if you can only do 800 letters at a time? And it's all in smaller pieces. So the federal program broke things up into fairly large chunks, about 100,000 letters long, and distributed those around the country and around the world in a multi-sweatshop operation to try and decode those. With what we developed with whole genome shotgun sequencing, we use unique mathematical tools and high-end computing to basically solve jigsaw puzzles. Assembling genomes is very similar to solving a jigsaw puzzle. You pick up one piece and you compare it to all the others. With the genome, we have 800 letters of genetic code that you compare to all the other pieces until you find overlaps. Turns out we had 27 million pieces, so you can't do that manually in any one lifetime. But we, in 1999, built the third largest computer in the world to actually help us with that calculation. So we substituted high-performance computing, new mathematical algorithms, and automation for tens of thousands of scientists.
In other words, that's partially why you could work quicker and why you could work cheaper.
That's right.
In other words, once you invest in that piece of technology, everything else, the cost reduces.
The biggest costs were all the people involved around the world. We did it in one building with a small team because we had used computational tools to replace manual labor.
So at one point there, you're using very, very cutting-edge computational tools, new modeling or new computing insights. What was it, do you think, that made the others doubtful of that so that they kept doing it sort of with this year's technology instead of next year's?
I think the problem is just the nature of building large federal programs. Once they're set in motion, it's like trying to steer a giant barge down the Mississippi River. There's really no room to turn. It's too bulky of a bureaucracy. And basically, they were afraid if our method worked, it sort of shattered their entire program, which, in fact, it almost did.
And let me put that in real-world terms. In other words, if they've got a program that's projected to cost $3 billion, that's $3 billion that's going to go into somebody's pockets along the way, all those scientists around the world, the people who manage it. And if you're showing that it can be done with a new tool, quicker, leaner, what about that $3 billion? Right.
Yeah, and that's what I think several of the people that were most vocal in their attacks were worried about is we actually did it for $100 million. They were worried about Congress cutting off their budget, so they resorted to the name-calling and the, you know, trying to create fear that we were going to tie it up in a commercial company, which was nonsense because they were doing it at the same time. It would have been impossible anyway. Nobody ever examined the sensibility of it. You know, the good thing is the competition brought it much more to the public attention.
Exactly. People love a story. There's more of a story when you've got competition.
That's right. And so probably more people know the word genome than they would have any other way. So maybe it really served a public purpose.
Interesting. The thing that I mentioned also in the top, which is that you have since that breakthrough sequenced one individual's genome. For people, just to put it in shorthand, that one that you did originally was parts of five different people.
It was a composite of five different people, and the public program was a composite. It was only half the genome, but it was a composite of maybe 200 different ones. Turns out neither represented humanity in underestimated human-to-human variation. So coming out of 2001, the assumption was we all had the same set of genes, and we only differed in one letter of genetic code out of 1,000 from each other. It didn't make sense to me then that we could cover the diversity of humanity with that, and so we went back and did it much more completely, looking at the whole set of the genome, the chromosomes that we get from both of our parents. And it turns out you and I differ from each other by 1% to 2% versus one letter out of 1,000. Let me put that number in context. We thought we only differed from chimps by 1.27%.
That's exactly what I've read.
So fortunately, that number has changed too, or we would be in deep trouble.
If we differed less from each other than we did from chimps?
Yes. So it turns out we differ from chimps by 5% to 6% when you look at the totality of the genome, the complete diploid genome. But it makes me much more comfortable with the range of humanity that we're 1% to 2% different across 3 billion people. As an individualist, I certainly like that notion, and it makes the biology a lot more comprehensible.
I mean, just because I have often referred to that chimp number, what is the accurate number now? It had gone up from 93 to 98 and a half, kind of, and what is it really now?
It's probably more like 94 to 95% when you take all the variations into account. There's regions when you align them, it does show up at the 1.27% difference, but it was that same kind of reasoning that got us in trouble with comparing humans at the 0.01% level.
I find the stuff you're working on now for the future at the Venter Institute and so on really exciting, and I'm going to mention two things and then ask you to tell me about them. One is the medical part, human genomic medicine. Then there's environmental genomics, which is quite exciting. And then there's synthetic life. So let's talk about each of those. What's going on now? I mean, I think the hope people have always had for this was that it would help us medically.
So we're trying to set up to do 10,000 human genomes over the next decade. We have the tools to answer virtually all the questions about what's nature and what's nurture. Once we can understand that, we can go into this preventative medicine paradigm by knowing what our genetic code will tell us about the future risk for disease. And as medicine progresses, we'll be able to do more and more to alter our genetic destiny by changing our lifestyle, taking preventative drugs such as statins, changing behavior.
And let me ask a quick question on that. I interviewed Matt Ridley when he did Nature Via Nurture. He's the author of The Genome, but also Nature Via Nurture, in which he said the old battle of is it environment or is it genetics, he says it's really an ongoing interaction. What was fascinating to me was I had come down to the idea that you were born with a blueprint and it kind of acted out and your environment would interact with that. But he says it's interacting on a constant basis.
No, he's right. Actually, he's a great author and wrote a very understandable background book on genomics that people might want to refer to. It is ongoing. Our genetic code won't predict our life outcomes. It will give us statistical probabilities, and examples I use in boxes throughout my book talk about different gene variations that I have and what they might mean. And I show simple examples like eye color. You can't look at my genetic code and know for certainty that I will have blue eyes. I have a high statistical probability. And that's what the genome's going to give us, is probabilities, very few yes-no answers.
And right. And you even point out a few where it doesn't seem to jibe. I think you say that you get your best work done late at night, you're not an early riser, and that in your genome that wouldn't show up.
Exactly. I sort of came up the opposite in there. And I sort of show those things to help put in context that attributing complex behaviors to single genes is extremely unlikely. And so I try to make some degree of fun with these. There's supposedly a risk-taking allele. It turns out I have a moderate one, which made people quite happy that it was at least that far along. Just because things show up as correlations doesn't mean they're in any way causal.
And right.
Trying to explain complex behavior on the basis of one or a few genes, we need to dispel those notions because it's important for eliminating the fear of the genetic code from a genetically deterministic type of thinking.
I see what you're saying. Yeah, the more that we realize it's an ongoing real-time interaction, the less fear there should be in getting the information.
Yes. We are very genetic animals in the sense that almost every human trait has a genetic component. But as we've shown from single cells with the minimal genome and with synthetic life, you can't define any life based on its genetic code alone. It's the genetic code plus the environment. If that's true for the most basic single cell, with our 100 trillion cells, environment is absolutely essential.
Talk about this environmental genomics and the work that you've been doing in the ocean.
Well, in fact, a fourth biography in my book is actually a sailing biography from having my first sailboat, a Lightning, in Vietnam, to combining my two loves of science and sailing by doing a circumnavigation and taking samples of water every 200 miles and sequencing all the DNA that we isolate from organisms in that water. And we found as many as 40,000 species in a barrel of seawater.
Often I repeat things because I have a feeling if I were listening, I wouldn't quite catch that. 40,000 species in just a barrel of ocean water.
That's right. And these are unique. 85% of them are unique every 200 miles throughout the ocean. So instead of the ocean being a giant homogeneous soup, it's millions of unique environments. In one paper earlier this year, we described 6 million new genes, which more than doubled the number of genes discovered by science in the public databases. So we're at the early linear stages of discovery on our own planet.
What's the value of that, specifically, let's say, in terms of climate change?
Well, we've known the chemistry of the oceans. We haven't known the biology behind that chemistry. One of the things we found where organisms have near the surface have a photoreceptor similar to our own rhodopsins in our eyes that capture sunlight, convert that to electrical energy in the cell. That's how they live in these low nutrient environments. That's part of the carbon cycle. But also we're using those same tools, those same genes now to develop synthetic fuels by biological processes. We have a new possible jet fuel, an additive to replace ethanol. That we make by engineering cells through these synthetic genomic processes. So it gives us an understanding of the environment, but even more excitingly, perhaps some ways to break our dependency of taking carbon out of the earth, burning it, and putting it in the atmosphere.
And I think the other part of it that I read was to maybe fiddle with some of those organisms so that they absorb more carbon than they are.
Well, in fact,
on both ends of it. Right?
Yes, the ultimate source for renewable energy is that we can capture the carbon back from CO2, convert that into sugars, then into fuels, and then recapture that in a continuous cycle.
Okay. What's the biggest question you're asking yourself right now, very briefly?
I'm very worried about what this experiment we're doing with our planet of putting this massive amount of carbon in the atmosphere. I'm an experimental scientist. I don't want to take this experiment to conclusion because it may have a catastrophic ending. So if we can, as quickly as possible, break our dependency on oil and coal, we have a chance for maybe reversing some of this damage before we get to that critical point.
Excellent. So again, the book is A Life Decoded. A website where you can learn more is jcvi.org. JCVI, that's the J. Craig Venter Institute.org. Thank you, Craig Venter, and keep up the good work.
Thanks for having me with you.
Okay.